Larry Swearingen is a prisoner in Texas. If the state has its way, he'll be dead within the hour. This is Execution Watch. Huntsville, Texas, death penalty capital of the Western world, where prison staff is preparing to put Swearingen to death by injecting him with a deliberate drug overdose. During the next hour, KPFT's Execution Watch will broadcast live coverage of the death in Texas, the state responsible for half the executions in the U.S. Execution Watch host Larry Douglas, criminal defense attorney Mike Gillespie, Huntsville reporter outside the death house, Linda Huhan, and special interview guest Tom Jackman, a reporter for the Washington Post who has covered the Swearingen case. The execution watch for Larry Swearingen begins. Good evening. This is KPFT Radio Execution Watch. We are here because the state of Texas is preparing to execute Larry Swearingen. This is August 21st, 2019. And whether you're listening to one of our live broadcasts or KPFT simulcast, we're on the archives, and we just thank you for joining us. I'm Larry Douglas. I'm serving as your host this evening. If you were tuning in for Arab Voices, usually heard at this time on Wednesdays from 6 to 7, please check back next week when it resumes its regular schedule. For our regular listeners, many of you already know that we have this broadcast whenever there is an execution in Texas. Fortunately, we haven't been with you for quite a while, and it is our hope not to be with you very often. But unfortunately, when there is an execution, we seek to bring to you live coverage of the execution and also from a perspective that is more in tune with what our listeners would likely want to know. If there are things that you have to any kind of suggestions or advice you want to give us, we welcome your comments. This is not a radio call-in show, but you should feel free to give us your comments off the air. Tonight we stand as a witness to the state of Texas, which has planned to carry out Swearingen's death sentence. There was a Supreme Court case pending about an hour ago. We found out now that the Supreme Court has denied the stay of execution. So as a result of the denial of that stay, we are going to proceed, apparently, with the execution. Joining us, me in the studio tonight, is Mike Gillespie. Mike and I are going to have a little discussion between the two of us as to the facts, the underlying facts of the case. And also joining us will be an interview guest, Tom Jackman, a Pulitzer Prize journalist from the Washington Post, who has written a lot about the Swearingen case. We also have a live report from the death house from Linda Huhan. So when Linda's available, is Linda available right now? So if Linda's available right now, we will go to Linda Huhan at the death house in Huntsville. And I should press what button now? Don't press the button at all. Linda's already there. Good evening,
I'm
Linda.
I'm here. Yes, I'm here.
This is Larry, and I'm here with Mike Gillespie, and we are just checking in with you to see what are things like right now in Huntsville. What's the attitude like? What's the atmosphere?
Well, it's not real, you know, loud or anything. It's quiet. Everybody's controlling themselves. We did have the Trotter family show up over here in the beginning, and they asked them to leave to go to the other side, but they went peacefully. They didn't cause any problems.
And when you say the Trotter family was there, this is the family of the victim.
Of the victim, yes.
How many of them were there?
Well, there was only about five that came over here with us, wanting to take pictures of us, of all the protesters.
Okay.
And we went to the TDCJ guard and asked him to please ask him to leave.
Okay, but they were just there. They weren't causing any problem or anything, were they?
No, they wanted to take pictures of us, I guess, to put in the newspaper or whatever. I don't know.
Okay, and we do understand that they did lose a loved one, and we should be concerned about them as well, I'm sure.
We are concerned, you know, very much concerned. That's why we didn't want, but we didn't want to have any confrontation, you know.
And there was none. Neither the protesters nor the Trotter family caused any kind of confrontation.
No.
So that's a good thing.
Yes.
Okay. And as to the Swearingen protesters, Swearingen supporters, I'm sorry, the supporters of the abolition of the death penalty and Swearingen support group there, what's going on with them?
Okay, there's 22 people here and one dog, and that's what we've got out here to protest for Larry.
Okay, we're counting dogs now, Linda.
Yeah, well, we have a dog here, and he's on a leash, but he's barked a couple of times, so we think he's voicing his opinion.
Okay, and these are people in support of Larry Swearingen and also against the death penalty, correct?
Yes.
So what's the atmosphere like, Linda?
It's calm right now. Gloria Rubeck, you know, said her piece, what she wanted to say, and it's very calm. We're just waiting for them to cross the line, across the street.
So it's rage to say that they have not crossed the road yet.
They have not, but we're not sure if they're going to cross the road because there's no witnesses. He asked for no witnesses, and we don't know if the ministers, we haven't seen any of the ministers here, so we don't know if, oh, there's one minister going.
Okay.
But we have not seen him go across yet, so we're not sure.
Let's talk a little bit more about that, Linda.
Okay.
Larry Swearingen asked that there be no witnesses at all.
No witnesses at all. He's a minister. He didn't want his friends and family to witness it. He didn't think it would be a good thing.
Okay. So Larry Swearingen indicated that he wanted to spare his friends and family members of witnessing the execution.
Yes, and he had family members that wanted to be with him, but he didn't want that.
Okay. So if there are no witnesses, then clearly there would be no witnesses to cross the road, so to speak.
No, so to speak, there won't. Just when we see the minister, if he crosses the street, he may have gone in another door. We're not sure.
Okay. Now the minister, is it usual for a minister to always be there, correct?
Yes, but this is his very own Catholic minister, his Catholic priest, I should say.
Okay.
And they gave him his last, last rites last night, or whatever they call it, whatever the Catholics call when they, you know, give him like a communion. And because they wouldn't let him in yesterday, they said he wasn't on the list, but he got it cleared and he was able to come in last night and give him his last rites.
So Larry Swearingen's priest came in last night and gave him his last rites. Linda,
there was a mass. It was a complete mass.
Okay. Now, do we have any idea whether the Catholic priest is even going to come back tonight?
He's here.
Oh, he is there.
He's here, but we don't know where he went. We don't see him now.
Okay, but you have seen the Catholic priest, and it is your understanding that Larry Swearingen, who asked that there be no witnesses, is agreeable to have the Catholic priest there.
Yes, he asked for him to be there.
See, he specifically asked for the Catholic priest to be there.
Yes.
Okay,
he won't be in the chamber with him, but he'll be in the witness room.
Right. But the Catholic priest is there as a witness, correct?
Yes.
Okay. And so I guess we'll know when the priest comes out whether the action is complete.
Yes, we will know when it's complete because they'll start announcing it. They haven't let any reporters onto the property like they normally do. They let them go right up in front of the door. They're keeping them all out here.
Now, but the reporters who are being kept out there, they're being kept out there specifically at Larry Swearingen's request. Is that correct?
No, I don't think so. I think there's some reporters inside of there, but they're not the reporters out here that are taking pictures. They're not letting them get close to where they usually let them get. They're making them stand out here at the street under a tree.
Do you have any idea why that is, Linda?
No, because they didn't know either. They said this is the first time it's ever happened.
Okay. And in terms of the reporters who are inside, do we have any idea how many there are?
We know Wayne Arnold's in there from Channel 11, I believe, and Carrie Blakinger's in there from the Houston Chronicle. But as far as anybody else, we're not sure because they didn't come over and talk to us before they, you know, went in. They go in before, you know, witnesses cross the line and everything.
Okay. Do you see the reporters go in typically, Linda?
No, we did not see them go in because they went in another door.
Okay. And do we know about how many reporters are normally present?
Normally there's like three or four, but we know of two that are there.
So if there are reporters there, and typically there are very few, two, three, or four reporters, and you know that there are two there?
We know there's two in there, yes.
Okay. And in terms of other than his wish not to have his family and friends as witnesses, do we know of any other final requests from Mr. Swearingen?
No, he gave a final statement to his brother, but his brother has not released that yet. So I don't know when he's going to release it, but he has not released it to us yet.
Okay.
He's still at the hospitality house. He has not come over. I think he was having a hard time with this, and he said he would just go to the church.
Okay, now physically, now where is the hospitality house?
It's like one block to the left from here on 10th Street, and it's like three houses down.
Okay.
From 10th Street, or yeah, 10th Street.
Okay. Is there anything else that you'd like to let the listeners of KPFT Radio know right now regarding the execution, Linda?
No, all I can say is today Larry told his family that whatever happened, he was okay with, because he's tired. Basically, that's what he said. I'm tired.
He's tired.
Yeah, he's been six. This is the sixth, you know, execution date, and I think he's just tired. He sent all of his belongings out yesterday and today because I was in visitation room both days, and they brought all of Larry's belongings. So he was apparently planning on going because he let everything go. And normally they give that to the chaplains, and the chaplains give it to the family at the hospitality house, but Larry gave it to the family himself.
Okay. Okay, Linda, we'll be checking back with you for whatever news there might be.
We do know that Larry has donated his body to science. There's a new program that donates their brains, and they will take what they need and what they want to harvest, and then eventually they will cremate it and send it back to the family. It's all free.
And this process of donating the body to science, Linda, you're saying this is a new program?
It's something new with TDCJ. They used to not want the bodies, but maybe they're trying to check to see, you know, how bad the bodies are when they get cremated or when they get executed. We don't know, but we do know that there is a new program, and once the unit has implemented it, and they're giving it to the guys 14 days out from their execution and explaining it to them and saying, if you want to sign this, you know, this is what will happen. And so they signed it, and, you know, Larry's the first one. He's the first one to do it.
Okay. So this is certainly a sad situation, a grim situation, but that's a sort of a glimmer, a silver lining to an otherwise dark cloud.
I wish we knew why they started this with inmates, because they used to not do that.
Well, I'm not sure that the why is really all that important, Linda. The fact is, it's being done now,
yes,
and it's a good thing. It's a good thing. Okay. Well, we'll be checking back with you, Linda.
All right, if I see someone crossing over, I will call you.
Thanks.
I'll call Elizabeth.
Thank you.
Okay, bye-bye.
Thank you. So that was Linda Huhan at the Death House. We are preparing for the execution of Larry Swearingen, and she's mentioned to you before that Mr. Swearingen did not want any of his friends and relatives to witness. We've got an interview later with Tom Jackman. Tom is a Pulitzer Prize writer for the Washington Post, and he has studied and written about the Larry Swearingen case very extensively. So he'll be calling in a few minutes, but until he calls in, Mike and I are just going to have a little discussion. So Michael, I've been speaking for the last several minutes, and I don't want to hog the whole thing. Are we ready for Larry? Not ready yet. You'll let us know. Okay, great. Okay, so let me just let Michael in. So, Mike, we're just going to have a little discussion between me and you.
Well, it's been a long time we've had a show. We've had a peaceful summer.
And that's right, that's a good thing.
This is our first one in a while, but from what I read, we have 10 cent in the next 3 months. That's a lot of executions. I've also read, seemed like this is the mood for executions. I saw yesterday 3 other states had executions. And I've also read now the federal government has got 5 set for federal executions. So even though there's been a lull this summer, it looks like everything's getting back in high gear again.
Yeah, it seemed as though we did have a mighty lengthy lull, which was a good thing. I thought of a trend in the right direction, but unfortunately we seem to be going in the wrong direction now. But we'll see how. Let's just focus on this case for a minute.
Yes, Mr. Swearingen. What do you think, Larry?
Well, my concern about this case is so many death penalty cases are, is that it's just taken so long to get to where we are. This is a case that the murder, the killing occurred in the end of 98, beginning of, and found body found at the beginning of 99. This is 2019. So am I getting a signal that hang on. Okay. This is 2019. So it's been 20 years. And if this case were tried today, I think the outcome would have been different since things have changed a lot in terms of expert testimony and scientific information. But could you give the listeners just a brief overview, Michael, of the facts of the case?
Well, let's talk about the case if I was presenting the case to a court.
Or just what the facts were.
Well, what the facts were is that a young girl was found missing. They had reports that the last person to see the girl was Larry, and that was at the college campus where she went and he worked. And after she was missing, they didn't know what happened to her.
And this young girl was Melissa Trotter.
Right.
Okay, and this is a case out of Montgomery County,
right. And they,
here. And so she was a student at Lone Star, what is now Lone Star College.
They suspected him because he had called up and reported there was a burglary in his house, that his house got all torn up. And when they asked him, do you know Melissa Trotter, he said no. Well, they found out a lot of things that bothered them, including that she had his number in her pager, and they found hair strands of her in his car. So with that confrontation, he now admits not only did he know her, but they were dating and he was the boyfriend.
Okay, and she went missing, I believe, on December 8, 1998.
And he went to jail right away.
3 days later.
Because they suspected him right off the bat, but they had no proof. But they did have him on a stolen car charge. Seemed like he had bought a car at a dealership and didn't pay for it. And instead of being a civil suit, they filed stolen car. So he was arrested and put in jail within 3 days of the murder, which became a big issue later on. Because one of the defenses is that the woman was alive while he was in jail and wasn't murdered until 2 weeks after he was in jail.
And she her body was discovered, I believe, on January 25 days later.
That's right.
In the Sam Houston National Forest.
By a hunter. And his first defense was it couldn't be me because I was in jail. Now, they really have very little evidence on him. They tried to get DNA evidence in. They tried to get in hair fibers. They tried to get in fibers from the truck. They tried to get in all this forensic evidence. And in his first trial, it all got in. But as we all know, this was the early stages of forensic evidence. All of this evidence was later disputed, and a lot of this evidence is now in dispute.
Okay, and we're going to pick up on this again in a few minutes, Michael. I believe we've got Tom Jackman, the reporter for the Washington Post, the Pulitzer Prize winner recipient reporter from the Washington Post. And Mr. Jackman has written extensively about the Larry Swearingen case. Tom Jackman, are you there?
I am indeed.
Hello, Tom. This is Larry Douglas. I'm here with Michael Gillespie, and we're talking about the Larry Swearingen case.
Yes,
and I understand.
Sir.
I read an article that you wrote a little while ago about the case itself, particularly as it relates to forensic evidence. Would you share just a bit about the case itself or the article you wrote recently?
Well, the forensic evidence was a big part of the case originally, and now the state would like to say, well, it's not really that big a part of the case. It was more of a circumstantial case. But basically, the victim, Melissa Trotter, had a leg of pantyhose wrapped around her neck. And although they had searched his home twice looking for the match, or looking for anything, it was until his landlord came across a leg of pantyhose that they brought it in, and they matched it to the leg around Melissa's neck. But there are experts who have looked at this now who say, this doesn't match. These two pieces don't go together. This isn't good.
Wait. Hold on for a minute there, Jack. You're saying that at trial, the testimony was that the two pieces of evidence matched, that the two legs of pantyhose matched, but now that they don't?
That's correct. At trial, the state expert testified that this was a match to the exclusion of any other pantyhose in the history of pantyhose. And so that was the testimony that the jury heard. And so other people have since looked at this pantyhose and said, when you put these together, they're clearly not a match. And I should say that Montgomery County prosecutors don't agree with that, but this is what three different experts who've looked at this said, is that these pieces don't match up. And so that was a big part of it, because the prosecutors in their closing argument said that the pantyhose found in Swearingen's home was the smoking gun. That was what linked him to the crime. And so that was the big one. The other one, one of the other big ones is the blood found under her fingernails, the victim's fingernails. They were able to get a DNA profile out of it, and it was not Larry Swearingen. Now, this was known to the jury, and so that's not new necessarily. I did speak to Larry Swearingen in the last hour, and he told me that DNA profile of whoever's blood that was has never been put in the national database. It's only been put in the Texas database. So that's another forensic problem.
Let me stop you again, Tom, because you just mentioned that you spoke to Larry Swearingen within the last hour?
I did. Excuse me.
Are you at liberty to talk about that at all?
Sure.
How that went? Could you tell us a little bit about that?
He said, I said, how are you? He said, I'm scared. I hate to say it, but I'm scared. And he said he was firm in his Catholic faith, but he was still scared. He wasn't going to eat, and that he was he's innocent, and that he was friends with Melissa, and that they turned that friendship into a murder case. And he said, I need four votes from the Supreme Court to keep this going. We were actually talking about, well, what if this blood evidence goes into the national database and comes back and incriminates someone else? He said, well, that's good, but I'm not sure if I'm going to be around to see that. I need four votes from the Supreme Court. And you may know that in the last half hour, the Supreme Court did not give him those votes. They have rejected the habeas petition.
Okay. I'm just a little bit curious. Swearingen is on the row preparing to meet his end.
right?
How do you manage to get a phone call?
Hey, man, I'm good. No, that's not really it. It's that I'd gotten to be talking to his friends, the people that have been closest to him in recent years, and his lawyers, and they asked him if he would call me, and he said yes, and he did call.
Okay, now, and I was told there that he'd given away all of his belongings on yesterday. Do you know anything about that? Did he talk about that at all?
I didn't know that, or I would have asked him about that. Okay. No, I didn't know that.
Okay. Anything further regarding that discussion you had with Swearingen that you
well,
can't share with us?
Well, the other thing is that he helped craft a statement that one of his friends, Christopher Jones, wrote out for him. And they supplied that to me earlier today. Let's see how long this thing is. It is 7 paragraphs going into a little bit of detail about why he's an innocent man. And we'll be, publishing that as soon as we get the word that he's not around. But he said that...
So what you're telling us is that this was a statement.
The last words of Larry Swearingen is how it's headed.
And it is intended only to be published upon his death.
That's my instructions from his people. And he referred to that a number of times in our talk around 6 o'clock Eastern, which would have been about 5 o'clock your time.
Okay, so for that reason, we won't go any further into that statement then.
Well, I'll tell you what it says. I'm not going to send it to you right now, but his first line is, "Today the state of Texas murdered an innocent man." And towards the end, he says that he spent 19 years in solitary confinement. I learned Texas law to the point where I proved my innocence beyond any shadow of doubt, although unfortunately for me, actual innocence is not legal cause for stopping an execution.
I know this is a brief conversation with him. I assume you never spoken to him before.
I had not.
Okay. And what kind of impression did you get from him in terms of the kind of person you think he might be?
He seemed friendly. I hate to use the word warm, but he was perfectly personable, and so I thought he had a good grasp of of what was going on and the facts, and he said there was a big spread of food laid out for him that he was not going to eat, and he was as upbeat as could be in the situation, which was an hour and a few minutes away from execution.
You said something, Tom, about him speaking about his relationship with Melissa Trotter, and I don't want to be causing any problem with the family or not, but what kind of relationship, the Trotter family, but what kind of relationship did he characterize that he had with Melissa?
Well, we did talk about that a little bit, and because he said he was friends with her, and I said, I've seen that you've said elsewhere that you were friends with benefits, and he said, I have said that, that's true, but really, we were just friends. This was a friendship, and what did he say? I'm looking at my handwritten notes here. Melissa's friends had come forward and described me this as a dating relationship, and so they were seeing each other. He was married. I think that she may have had other relationships as well, so they were kind of keeping it quiet.
Okay.
I'm Mike Gillespie, Tom. The one thing that's always bothered me in this case is his statement when the police asked him if he knew her.
Right.
And
he denied it.
He didn't know her.
He did a lot of lying back in those days.
What bothers me is not a lie. You just think that if there's a girl who's your friend and a girl who you were intimate with and the police tell you she's dead, your response should be something before that. Then I don't know her. Like, how did she die? What happened to her?
Well, when they were questioning him, she hadn't been found, so she was just missing then. But even so, you know, he denies knowing her. He gave a lot of half-truths in those early interviews. He denied, you know, being home or being on the county college campus that day. You know, he filed a false police report that his house had been burglarized and his jet ski had stolen. So, yeah, there was a lot of playing around with the truth back then.
So how do you think that affects the appellate courts when they're looking to reverse him on technicalities on forensic evidence?
I think it hurts him a lot. Yeah. And I think that this, you know, Trump appointee that wrote the last opinion on Friday about this case adopted a lot of those kind of points that the prosecution made. And this this judge is a former Solicitor General in Texas. And, I mean, he adopted points that I think are clearly false now, but it didn't matter because somebody, some prosecutor had chucked it in a brief once, and this kind of stuff about the stories that he told in those first days in December of 1998, I'm sure that hurt him a lot.
Well, let's assume a second, instead of the facts that the government wants to say, let's assume a second that the real facts was that she was at his house and something happened and she ended up dying. There's no evidence she was raped. There's evidence she was killed, evidence that she was murdered. But that's not a death penalty case.
If that's correct.
He would have contacted the police and said what happened, he'd probably be home by now.
Right.
So is he really being killed for lying?
Well, lying and this, you know, possibly spurious evidence of a sexual assault, because that's the aggravating factor.
Yeah, but was there sexual assault, or was it just... I didn't see no evidence of sexual assault.
I didn't either.
Again, if you try to...
And I just need to break in just for a minute to just let our listeners know that you're listening to KPFT Radio 90.1 on the FM dial. And this is Execution Watch. For those who tuned in to listen to Arab Voices, tune in next week. But we're here broadcasting Execution Watch because tonight it appears that Texas is in the process of executing, carrying out the death penalty on Larry Swearingen.
If they were together voluntarily and it got out of control, it might not have been a sexual assault. It might just have been sudden rage. There might have been things here that we don't know about.
Right. That would be murder, too, at the worst, right? Heat of the moment.
All kinds of reasons to go to court and get a sentence of jail time and to be paroled out by now. But what do you think about these other things that he's been doing in jail? Like, what do you think about that letter written in Spanish?
Hurt him again, the same thing, and then trying to get one of his fellow colleagues on death row, Anthony Shore, who had killed a number of women in a similar fashion, strangling them with a ligature, trying to get him to take credit for the death of Melissa Trotter. Those things were also cited by the Fifth Circuit.
I think there's a third girl now, a friend of his, who's claiming she used to work with Ms. Trotter, and Ms. Trotter was being stalked by a man who wanted to choke her.
That's correct.
So we have three letters. And that first letter in Spanish, he puts in information that only the police know to prove to the police the Spanish man did it. Then he admits he wrote the letter, so he's admitting that he knew things like the color of her underwear that only the police knew.
Right.
Gotta hurt him.
I think you're exactly right. Even though those, you know, aren't really probative of any crime being committed, but it looks bad.
If I was a writer, I'd write a book on why you should not talk to the police and use this case as an example.
That's right. Example number 5,000.
Tom, getting back to the article itself that you wrote, I mean I guess. Expert testimony. It just amazes me how powerful it is, and to see words like unique physical match, that is the two legs of the pantyhose, that is being a matching to the exclusion of all other pantyhose and resulting in the DA being able to say that this is the, at the time, this is the smoking gun. That had to be pretty powerful.
Absolutely. Jurors, you know, are looking for guidance. Most jurors have, you know, not set foot in a courthouse or a courtroom, much less a murder trial. And so they appreciate and take seriously the counsel of expert witnesses who tell them, who first typically it's explained to them why they're an expert and what their their professional qualifications are, and then they proceed to lay out what testing they did and why they came to the conclusion they came to. And unless you've got a really sharp defense attorney who's able to poke holes in that, who've got their own experts, that has a lot of weight. And so those things you just said about an expert saying this is unique and to the exclusion of all others, even though the state crime lab has said in the last month she shouldn't have used those words with the pantyhose, and then the crime lab technician who said the blood under the fingernails, oh, that was probably just somebody else, you know, some cop or somebody in the lab that contaminated the sample. The state crime lab issued a letter earlier this month saying that was bad testimony. She shouldn't have said that. She had no reason to believe that, no knowledge that there was anybody contaminating those fingernail clippings.
In fact, you said something very interesting. The argument about forensic evidence wasn't that the forensic evidence was wrong. It was that the testimony was inaccurate. They were reversed because of the wording of the experts on the stand, not the actual test themselves.
That's right. They stood by the tests other than...
Because the test showed nothing actually to hurt him.
That's right. The blood, yeah, the blood seemingly helps him. And one of their big arguments was, here's blood from another man under her fingernails. That is terrific exculpatory evidence. But then their witness stands up and says, we just accidentally put that in there. It was a cop who cut himself shaving. That was actually put forth as one theory for how the blood got there.
But wasn't it obvious that second blood was there after the murder because of the color of the stain? It wasn't at the time of the murder. Something happened afterwards to contaminate it.
Well, that was one way that they've attacked it, is by saying, you know, there's been argument about what the color of the blood was, and was it bright, so it was red, so it was fresh, which would fit with the theory that she hadn't been dead very long. We haven't discussed the whole decomposition aspect, but her body did not seem very decomposed for someone who had been dead and laying in the forest for 25 days.
Could you talk for a few minutes then, Tom? You mentioned not having spoken about the decomposition evidence. Could you talk about that just for a minute?
Sure. So she disappears on December 8th. She's found on January 2nd. And when she's found, her organs are intact. The food in her stomach is intact. Her brain can be sectioned and her pancreas can be sectioned, and they're able to examine the organs. And a body that is laying out in the open, and the temperatures range from the 30s to the 70s during the 25 days that she was gone, body that's laying out anywhere for that long is going to severely decompose, particularly the insides. The organs become liquefied. The food in the stomach disintegrates. And so the defense lawyers at trial did not really challenge that evidence. And then in the appeals process, they have challenged it. And Swearingen's lawyers came up with a number of forensic pathologists, but forensic entomologists who study the bugs that attack a human corpse, and that you can draw some inferences from how long the bugs have been on the body to show how long the body has been dead. And so there was a lot of testimony about that, and the original medical examiner who said she'd been dead for 25 days had very little knowledge in these areas. And so a number of experts said this woman hasn't been dead for more than 2 weeks. That's the maximum decomposition time on this body is 2 weeks. Some of them said just a few days. And Larry Swearingen had been in jail for 3 weeks. He had been arrested 3 days after she disappeared. So if she was only dead for 2 weeks, he couldn't have killed her.
So that clearly appears to be evidence of actual innocence.
There you go.
And your understanding of how much weight that apparently carried?
Well, in the end, it didn't carry very much with the appeals courts, some of whom said, I thought this was odd, well, these experts can't agree. Some of it say 2 days, some of it say 7 days, some of them say 14 days. So, you know, we here at the court, we don't know what to think, so we're going to stick with the 25 days. And that's how the courts treated that.
Is there any explanation why that second blood sample wasn't run? Seemed to be easier to run it than do all these appellate steps.
The blood under the fingernails?
Right, correct.
Well, they got a DNA profile out of it and then determined that it didn't match Swearingen, but that's as far as they've ever gotten with it.
But they haven't put it in the national database yet.
Correct.
Any reason why you think they haven't? That'd be a very simple thing to do on a
case
like this.
That would. And I didn't know that until Swearingen told me that, you know, an hour and a half ago.
Seems that's the easiest way to put that issue to rest.
Yeah. You know, and as he pointed out in our conversation, that, you know, national DNA database has resulted in a lot of big crimes getting solved.
But there was no evidence she was sexually abused.
The prosecutors would disagree, but it seems my reading of it that, I mean, her pants were on, you know, there's some claim of vaginal bruising there, but the defense would say that was not indicative of a sexual assault.
And actually, I think the wording was some vaginal area discoloration that may have been bruising.
There you go.
Which then may have been consistent
right.
With a sexual assault. But then the underlying rationale, the indictment was in the language of attempted sexual assault. So if there were no penetration, but there was an attempted sexual assault, that discoloration would, at least legally, support
right.
the verdict of guilty this case.
I think tearing pantyhose off could cause bruising. Don't know if tearing pantyhose off is a sexual assault or not.
Discoloration
right.
could have resulted in. But that was an interpretation of discoloration. The use of experts. I was talking to a major claims adjuster years ago talking about expert testimony in cases, and he said, Larry, look, you know, if I've got a case of a severed limb, do you know that I can go out and find an expert who'll actually testify that it'll grow back? It's amazing when the experts start to give opinions with the clear intention of affecting the verdict. And they're allowed to give opinions that if it might help the jury understand the underlying scientific evidence, they're allowed to do that. And, you know, it cuts both ways.
So long as they meet the Daubert standard of accepted science.
But even that changes. I mean,
at
the time of this case was tried. I mean, it had nothing to do with this case, but we had dog sniff cases here in the Houston area, especially down in Fort Bend County, where dog sniff evidence was considered a scientific evidence to identify people. And it's just flat out junk science.
But on this issue of the blood, if there was another person who did this, why would he go through the effort of killing her and not raping her? It makes no sense.
Hmm.
He would have raped her and killed her. He didn't rape her. He just killed her.
Right.
It's more like a frustrated boyfriend.
If indeed he even killed her. Okay,
we're talking about the other person. If there was another person besides Larry, why would he just be hiding out and jump up and kill her and strangle with her pantyhose and not sexually assault her? It sounds more like somebody who was dating and they had an argument about sex and anger, he might have done something to her. I sure wish sometimes people just be quiet when the police come and not talk.
How many times have you said it?
Well, actually, police will tell you that when people start talking, that makes them suspicious.
Now, Tom, I see that you're listed here as a Pulitzer Prize and lead writer.
I wish
writer.
You'd stop saying that.
That's what's on the script here, Tom.
It's there. It's true.
Okay. And you cover criminal justice?
Yes. I have a blog or vertical called True Crime.
Okay.
So I write about a lot of different things, both local and national. I covered the federal and local courts and cops in Kansas City for a number of years and then out here for a number of years.
And in terms of your estimation of this case as compared to others, to me it seems as though a stay to fully examine the underlying technical forensic evidence would not have hurt anything. And it just seems that would have been the appropriate thing to do. Do you have a feeling about that at all, Tom?
Not that I have opinions as a reporter, but that would seem, at least prudent at the Supreme Court level. They've never looked at this case. And, most death penalty cases are not a question of whether or not the guy did it. It's whether or not he deserves the death penalty. So when there's questions of actual innocence, those are the ones that I think deserve the closest look and the utmost scrutiny. And the fact that the Supreme Court didn't take this is a little bit surprising to me. Not much considering its current composition, but just in general, the theory that you just, enunciated, which was, when there's a claim like this, what is the harm in a stay? I'm with you.
There's also no evidence here of future dangerousness, and that's something we normally see when they're executing somebody. This guy really did not do much bad in the past. If he did this or not, I read nothing about how he was a danger in the future to society, to people in prison. It's a really unique death penalty case. I wonder if another county like Harris would even done a death penalty in a case like this.
Right. Good questions.
Well, Tom, we do thank you for the time that you spent with us. Do you have any parting words of wisdom for us or observations that you might want to have our audience consider?
I thought you raised the perfect one just there, Larry, which is that this is an actual innocence claim, and it needs to be examined from all sides before someone is put to death. And I'm not sure that was done.
I don't believe in polygraph tests, but did he ever offer to take a polygraph, at least through
counsel?
That's
a good question.
Excuse me?
That's a very good question. I don't know.
I know. I often will have clients do it, and they're secretive unless I want to be known, but sometimes at least gives people the reason to sit back and doubt it for a moment, if you can pass one.
Sure.
This case raises almost a lot more questions than answers. And we don't know what the finality is going to be, but I suspect that we're going to hear pretty soon.
Thanks, Larry. It was good talking to you.
Thank you, Tom. And I'll leave out the other descriptors as we sign off. Thanks a lot. We'll wrap this up in a few minutes, and we do
right.
Thank you for your time and for your opinions.
Sure.
Thanks a lot.
See ya.
Okay, Michael, I don't know if you've heard any more.
I started this show thinking he was probably, I didn't think it was a capital case, but I started the show thinking that whatever happened, he did it. I don't think so anymore. I have to listen to Tom and you talk. There's too many holes in this thing.
There are a lot of holes. But the other thing, Michael, I think the more we look at a case like this, the clearer it becomes to me that had this been a case that were tried today rather than 1998, 99, 2000, I guess he was found guilty in 2001, I think it would have been tried a whole lot differently.
I just look at it and see somebody who does one thing wrong, one murder, is normally not a capital case.
Well,
this is no past violent acts, no future acts, no dangerousness. Whatever happened was a one-time scenario that is normally not capital.
Well, when you consider that the evidence of the factors that make it a capital, if it were a murder at all, it becomes a capital by either a kidnapping, and we've discussed that the evidence of kidnapping was fairly weak, or attempted sexual assault, and that evidence was also fairly weak. But to his detriment, Larry Swearingen, you know, did some things, particularly the writing the letter, that really incriminated him.
That I would think make all the appellate judges not give him the benefit of the doubt that they might have given somebody else.
And I think if we learn anything from these cases, I mean, that you and I, we're street lawyers. We handle the gritty cases, not the capital murders and so forth. But we can learn a lot from these cases. The fact is, you have the right to remain silent. It's just so important not to speak. And if Larry Swearingen had not spoken, and from misdemeanors all the way up to capital murder, that's advice that we give our clients all the time. I don't care how smart you are. I mean, I've even had lawyers who get arrested, and they talk way too much. There's something about the police coming to you and asking you questions that make people feel like they should be compelled to talk, and you really shouldn't, because you're not going to win that. You're not going to win that discussion.
Of course, if you don't cooperate, you go to the DA's office and they tell you your client didn't cooperate. And if he had something to say, he should have said it at that time.
And if you had something to say, you say it to your lawyer, not to anyone else. So you have been watching, listening to Execution Watch. We have not heard from Huntsville yet, I don't think. So we don't know what the outcome in Huntsville is. We do know that there was no the stay was not granted. So at this point, what we know is our next scheduled execution. We hope it doesn't happen, but we schedule them because the state of Texas schedules them. Linda is on line one. Do I push line one then? Oh, Linda's already here. Okay.
I'm here.
Okay, so I don't have to push any buttons. Good, Linda.
Okay.
What's the most current word, Linda?
Okay, all the media just came back across, and they did have TDCJ chaplains with them. We did not see the TDCJ chaplains go in, but they came out with them. So apparently they were inside before we got here at 5.
Okay.
But it's over. It's finished now. He's gone. So sad.
Okay, and the support group that's there, are they still there with you?
Yes, everybody's still here.
And what's the atmosphere like now, Linda?
Sad. We're all sad, but you know, it's Texas. That's all we can say.
Are any of his family members there?
Yes, his brother is here, and his friend is here from. I don't know where his brother went. He was here.
Okay, and is this the brother who was going to read a statement after?
I think he didn't have the statement. He went back to find his other brother who has the statement. So
okay.
I haven't seen that other brother come up, so I don't know. He told us he did not have the statement.
Okay, this brother said he didn't have the statement. Okay. Well, it's been a while since we've done one of these, Linda.
Yes, I know.
But it appears we're going to start doing them more frequently by the end of this year, which is a tragedy in itself.
Well, we have one in 2 weeks, Billy Crutzinger.
Billy Crutch singer, I understand, is on September the 4th?
Yes.
Okay. If it happens, we hope it doesn't happen. But if
I hope it doesn't either.
Okay, okay. Any final words from Huntsville, Linda?
Nope. They've kept everybody away from where Jeremy Diesel is, and so none of us can hear anything he says.
And there were no confrontations or anything. Everything was peaceful.
Everything was smooth, yes.
That's good. That's good. Then we hope we don't have to talk to you on September 4th, Linda. It's not that we have anything against you. It's just that we only do this under these circumstances.
Yes, we hope it doesn't happen either because, unfortunately, Danny, Nitsky, and I are all three witnesses to him. He asked for us to be his witness. So we won't be out here, but we've got someone to replace us.
Okay, okay. Well, thank you for what you do.
All right.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Okay, again, you're listening to KPFT Radio 90.1 in Houston. Our next scheduled execution is September 4th. Our producer tonight has been Elizabeth Stein, technical director Otis McClay, engineer for the night is Rick Campbell, theme music from Victoria Panetta, She Monster International. This is Larry Douglas and Mike Gillespie signing off on another episode of KPFT's Execution Watch. Good night.
Don't you know? Some accused are innocent. Some get good lawyers, most don't. State of Texas, killing machines. Don't you know they're killing people? 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 Jesus name.